So I'm going to read a bit from the first chapter or two, just to give you a little bit of the sense of how she sees the place where she's living as having a spiritual significance. Again, the subtitle of the book, A Spiritual Geography. The High Plains, the beginning of the desert west, often act as a crucible for those who inhabit them. Like Jacob's angel, the region requires that you wrestle with it before it bestows a blessing. This can mean driving through a snowstorm on icy roads, wondering whether you'll have to pull over and spend the night in your car, only to emerge under tag ends of clouds into a clear sky blazing with stars. Suddenly you know what you're seeing. The earth has turned to face the center of the galaxy, and many more stars are visible than the ones we usually see on our wing of the spiral. Or a vivid double rainbow marches to the east, following the wild summer storm that nearly blew you off the road. The storm sky is gunmetal gray, but to the west the sky is peach streaked with crimson. The land and sky of the west often fill what Thoreau termed our need to witness our limits transgressed. Nature in Dakota can indeed be an experience of the holy. More Americans than ever, well over 70%, now live in urban areas and tend to see plains land as empty. What they really mean is devoid of human presence. Most visitors to Dakota travel on interstate highways that will take them as quickly as possible through the region, past our larger cities, to such attractions as the Badlands and the Black Hills. Looking at the expanse of land in between, they may wonder why a person would choose to live in such a barren place, let alone love it. But mostly they're bored. They turn up the car stereo, count the miles to civilization, and look away. Dakota is a painful reminder of human limits, just as cities and shopping malls are attempts to deny them. This book is an invitation to a land of little rain and few trees, dry summer winds and harsh winters, a land rich in grass and sky and surprises. On a crowded planet, this is a place inhabited by few, and by the circumstance of inheritance, I am one of them. Nearly 20 years ago, I returned to the holy ground of my childhood summers. I moved from New York City to the house my mother had grown up in an isolated town on the border between North and South Dakota. More than any other place I lived as a child or young adult, Virginia, Illinois, Hawaii, Vermont, New York, this is my spiritual geography, the place where I've wrestled my story out of the circumstances of landscape and inheritance. The word geography derives from the Greek words for earth and writing. And writing about Dakota has been my means of understanding that inheritance and reclaiming what is holy in it. Of course, Dakota has always been such a matrix for its Native American inhabitants, but their tradition is not mine, and in returning to the Great Plains, where two generations of my family lived before me, I had to build on my own traditions, those of the Christian West. When a friend referred to the Western Dakotas as the Cappadocia of North America, I was handed an essential connection between the spirituality of the landscape I inhabit and that of the 4th century monastics who set up shop in Cappadocia and the deserts of Egypt. Like those monks, I made a countercultural choice to live in what the rest of the world considers a barren waste. Like them, I had to stay in this place, like a scarecrow in a field, and hope for the brains to see its beauty. My idea of what makes a place beautiful had to change, and it has. The city no longer appeals to me for the cultural experiences and possessions I might acquire there, but because its population is less homogeneous than the plains society. Its holiness is to be found in being open to humanity in all its diversity, and the western plains now seem bountiful in their emptiness, offering solitude and room to grow. That's the first couple pages of the book. Anything strike you interesting? I'm welcoming not interruptions, but comments, questions, reactions along the way instead of at the end. So feel free to just interject anything you want. I'm struck especially by the notion that the vastness of the Dakotas gives you a sense of your limits. She says that it is a spiritual geography, because here we witness our limits transgress, the sense of, you know, the vulnerability of human beings out on this enormous plain where the weather can change so quickly and be so harsh. Dakota is a painful reminder of human limits. Another passage I found interesting in that at some points she says that the small towns of Dakota are very much like monastic communities. You know, everybody knows everybody. There's gossip. You can't get away from people you don't like. There are a number of connections. In certain ways, though, they're different. And here's one of the differences that she talks about, namely the way that, in fact, the Western Dakotas are being depopulated, and the tough economic times going on there mean that, you know, where do the teenagers go when they leave high school? They usually leave. And so in some ways, it's a very unstable place. So here's a section. Especially in Western Dakota, we live in tension between myth and truth. Are we cowboys or farmers? Are we fiercely independent frontier types or community builders? One myth that haunts us is that the small town is a stable place. The land around us was divided neatly in 160-acre rectangular sections following the Homestead Act of 1863, creating many section line rows with 90-degree turns. But our human geography has never been as orderly. The Western Dakota communities settled by whites are, and always have been, remarkably unstable. The Dakotas have always been a place to be from. Some 80% of homesteaders left within the first 20 years of settlement. And our boom and bust agricultural and oil industry economy has kept people moving in and out, mostly out, ever since. Many small town schools and pulpits operate with revolving doors, adding to the instability. When I look at the losses we've sustained in Western Dakota since 1980, about one-fifth of the population in Perkins County, where I live, a full third of the population has left in neighboring Corson County just in 10 years. And at the human cost in terms of anger, distrust, and grief, it is the prairie descendants of the ancient desert monastics, the monks and nuns of Benedictine communities in the Dakotas, who inspire me to hope. One of the vows the Benedictine makes is stability, commitment to a particular community, a particular place. If this vow is countercultural by contemporary American standards, it is countercultural in the way that life on the plains often calls us to be. Benedictines represent continuity in the boom and bust cycles of the plains. They incarnate and can articulate the reasons people want to stay.
I just was taken by that, having grown up in Iowa, mm-hmm. in a small community where similar patterns, of course, exist, and that the poignancy to those words just hit me, because from the time I was 6 years old, maybe, the message was, anybody who wants to succeed will lead. And I never thought about that until I read Wendell Berry in The Unsettling of America, and got a taste of his anger at the land-grant college professors whose job it was to nurture the farming communities, who were the ones who were sending that message out? They were the ones who were saying, if you're smart, leave. Mm-hmm. And the message was coming down the pike, and so I just naturally left. And it struck me that when I got out to Washington State, that almost everybody I knew my age was around from the area. And it was almost strange to me, because the model, that's when I realized that the model I had was a given. You would leave home. Mm-hmm. You would flee. Mm-hmm. And here were people who had grown up in the same street within six blocks or so. And I grieve for that, because I think it was systematic and almost kind of inevitable. The forces that were so big at work there. And so when she talks about the people whose stability, who render stability to a community, I really hear that. And I think now in my life, I'm almost fiercely committed to it, staying in my community for that very reason. I pass that along to my kids. And that's what I heard from that passage.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think in different ways, a lot of us probably feel the tension between commitment to a place and wanting that to shape often our children's and our own spirituality, and yet there's job mobility and all the, you know, we want the larger world and we want success or something too. I feel that tension in my own life too. Thanks. One of the spiritual dimensions of Dakota that she talks about is asceticism. Asceticism means essentially self-denial. And of course, self-denial of the body's needs is a big part of the monastic movement in Christianity. And in the passage I'm about to read, Norris talks about the ascetic dimensions of life on the Dakota plains. She's supported herself by a whole variety of jobs, librarian, teacher, artist in residence. She wants to stay in this place, but it's sort of piecing together all these small jobs. And so while she's an artist in residence, she often finds herself going to some community, you know, 300 miles away on the far side of North Dakota, and living in a fairly Spartan motel, which she says is rather like a monastic cell. So here's Norris. The grim surroundings used to overwhelm me. It was only when I began to apply what I had learned from the 4th century desert monks I was reading that I found I could flourish there. I began to see those forlorn motel rooms as monks' cells, full of the gifts of silence and solitude. While this caused no end of amusement among the staff at the North Dakota Arts Council, it worked. Instead of escaping into television every night, I found that I could knit, work on my writing, and do serious reading. In short, be in the desert and let it bloom. I had stumbled onto a basic truth of asceticism, that it is not necessarily a denigration of the body, though it has often been misapplied for that purpose. Rather, it is a way of surrendering to reduced circumstances in a manner that enhances the whole person. It is a radical way of knowing exactly who, what, and where you are, in defiance of those powerful forces in society: alcohol, drugs, television, shopping malls, motels, that aim to make us forget. A monk I know who directs retreats for other monasteries and therefore must travel more than most Benedictines has come to see air travel as a modern form of his ascetic practice. He finds the amenities offered, the instructions to relax and enjoy the flight, laughable when he stops to realize where he is. The insight of one 4th century monk, Evagrius, that in the desert most of one's troubles come from distracting thoughts of one's former life that don't allow us to live in the present, reflects what I regard as the basic principle of desert survival. not only to know where you are, but to learn to love what you find there. I live in an American desert, without much company, without television, because I am trying to know where on earth I am. Dakota discipline, like monastic discipline, requires me to know. In a blizzard or one of our sudden cold snaps that can take the temperature from 30 degrees above to 35 below in a matter of hours, not knowing can kill you. Whether the desert is a monastery, a one-room schoolhouse 40 miles from the nearest small town, where the children are telling you that poetry is dumb, or a cinderblock motel room whose windows rattle in the fierce winter winds, a healthy ascetic discipline asks you to rejoice in these gifts of deprivation, to learn from them, to care less for amenities than for that which refreshes from a deeper source. Desert wisdom allows you to be at home wherever you are. A brother came to visit Abba Moses and asked him for a word. The old man said to him, "Go, sit in your cell, and your cell will teach you everything." End of quote. Interesting passage in terms of asceticism, not as denial of the body, but as actually not being distracted from the body, paying attention to where you are. Reduced circumstances make you more appreciative of the spot on earth where you are. And her way of seeing so much of our, you know, contemporary life as basically a way of not being in the present, not being in the place where you really are, and foreclosing certain spiritual possibilities that can only come when you are attuned to your geography. I don't know if that philosophy inspires Holden at all, but in some ways, reduced circumstances, getting away from the distractions of the modern world, surely is, I think, one reason why people come to Holden, too.
It's the essence of a wilderness experience, mm-hmm. an oceanside experience. I was taken by how you can try to impart that upon your children, especially in a rural community. I think what is so scary about for kids living in where the town where I grew up is that there isn't a sense of the culture. And the culture that's presented is truly the television monoculture. Mm-hmm. And how I heard something just as really, this relates to Canadian radio. I listened to a lot of Canadian radio in Bellingham. In a northern Canadian community last winter, the television went out. Big storm, the big transmitter went out. For 3 weeks, they didn't have any television. At the time that the television transmitter was to be reinstalled, they interviewed people in the community. And one of the women said, "Well, you know, the first 2 or 3 days was really scary. I mean, the kids were, it was almost insurrection in the house. They were going nuts. They were just, she said, within 3 or 4 days, they started going out and they started playing out in the snow and they were doing things. And it was the story you'd expect. And because, you know, those of us who've given those things or who control those things, we see those as almost like, yeah, of course, experiences. But she said, you know, now that the transmitter's up, I feel kind of sad that it's coming back. And what was struck me about that was that she felt powerless. As long as that transmitter was there, she was powerless against it. She was grieving because now that transmitter was there and her kids knew it. And there was no way she could keep that television on. And it was just like, I just felt that. I thought, ooh, you know, what do you do? There it is. There is a perfect paradigm for what we're experiencing here, the robbery of the culture. And the beauty of that kind of truth is obscured by that power, the powerfulness of the culture, I guess, around it.
I don't know, what my Dakota asceticism, you know, has given me is that I'm trying to pass on to my children those other values, that there are other things than that monoculture on that tube that's sitting there in a box in the living room. So we try to spend a lot of time outdoors in whatever kind of weather, because that's what we had to do in North Dakota. We have a garden, we have a commitment to a piece of land. I don't know what we're going to do with it, but we have a commitment to that piece of land. That's real important. And I have to have faith that somehow my kids are going to pick up on some of those values that are important. They'll reject it for a while, I'm sure. Yeah. Those values that I know are still active in parts of my family, you know, that commitment to that place where, in that community where I grew up, is still there. And it's an economically viable community. Thank God, or whoever, whatever the forces that be. I think some part of human creativity has made that able to continue as a viable community, where so many other communities aren't, are being taken over by the agribusiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, an important difference between Dakota and, like you talked about, the similar sets of motivations that drive people to this wilderness,
right.
Draw people more than drive, I should say, is that the landscape is so horizontal,
mm-hmm.
and it takes a lot longer
yes.
to see it because it's horizontal.
Yeah.
A mountain or a tree stands in front of
boom.
You, and you can't miss it. You may not appreciate it, but you can.
Yeah.
And the horizontal, and I think about one of the most striking passages for me in the book was the monk whose character had been slighted, and who decided that instead of confronting the misunderstanding or whatever had happened, he would let his integrity outlive the poor reputation he had been given. And it took 9 years. But she said 9 years isn't very long in monastery. It was like, oh.
Yeah.
You know?
The theme of patience, you know, patience in that sense, or patience to appreciate the subtleties of a landscape in which, you know, the elevation changes are so subtle.
And persistence and endurance, mm-hmm. just sheer endurance.
Endurance.
Mm-hmm. The other character that kept coming to my mind was Barrett Holm from Giants in the Earth. You know, who got off the stagecoach after they got to their claim. Yeah, that's in Eastern Dakota, but just the same, it was a homestead claim. And she was just petrified because she realized there was nothing to hide behind.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of exposure that comes through the book, both to the weather and to the neighbors and the elements of the winter, it's very hard.
Let me go on now to another series of readings on, which I'll call ghosts, after one of her chapters, which really, the ghosts really are her family members. And Norris is raised as a Protestant, and she's very drawn in this book to Catholicism. But she's also, like I think all the women that I'm discussing, she's kind of coming back to a religion of her childhood that she rejected. And one of the themes of the book is the way that coming to terms with the ghosts in her family, namely the way that certain particularly female relatives have influenced her family, involves coming to terms not only with their peculiar psychology, but with their religion. And in the reading I'm going to do here, notice the two grandmothers, one of whom has a form of Protestant Christianity which Norris basically approves of, and another grandmother who has a very kind of harsh, negative theology that really constricts her and everyone around her. I'll start reading about in a passage in which Norris is reflecting back on some of the reasons why she rejected Christianity for a while. She's now, I would say, in her mid-40s, and she's looking back here on a period when she was in her 20s and living in New York. I needed a teacher who would not have scorned Evelyn Underhill's book, Mysticism, a book I'd found on my own, looking for some useful definition of religious experience. I needed liturgy and a solid grounding in the practice of prayer, not a demythologizing that left me feeling starved, thinking, if this is religion, I don't belong. Growing up and discovering who I was meant not going near a church again for nearly 20 years. That's an important theme, I think, in just about all the books I've read, that these women writers, at least, feel that to become an adult, they have to reject their childhood religion. During that time, I became a writer. I used to think that writing had substituted for religion in my life, but I've come to see that it has acted as a spiritual discipline, giving me the tools I needed to rediscover my religious heritage. It is my Christian inheritance that largely defines me, but for years, I didn't know that. In the early 1970s, when I was just out of college, working in New York City and hovering on the fringe of the Andy Warhol scene, a question crept into my consciousness one day, seemingly out of the blue. What is sin? I thought I should know, but my mind was blank. I felt like the little boy in The Snow Queen, who, as he's being carried off in the Queen's carriage, tries desperately to remember the Lord's Prayer, but can think of nothing but the multiplication tables. What is sin? It never occurred to me to go to a church for the answer. If the church hadn't taught me in my first 20 years what sin was, it probably never would. I now realize that the question was raised by the pious Protestant grandmother at my core. I had no idea she was there and didn't know how to listen to her. I didn't realize it at the time, but my move in 1974 from New York to South Dakota was an attempt to hear her voice more clearly. It was a search for inheritance, for place. It was also a religious pilgrimage. On the ground of my grandmother's faith, I would find both the means and the end of my search. When some 10 years later, I began going to church again because I felt I needed to, I wasn't prepared for the pain. The services felt like word bombardment, agony for a poet, and often exhausted me so much I'd have to sleep for 3 or more hours afterward. Doctrinal language slammed many a door in my face, and I became frustrated when I couldn't glimpse the word, capital W, behind the words. Ironically, it was the language about Jesus Christ, meant to be most inviting, that made me feel most left out. Sometimes I'd give up, deciding that I just wasn't religious. This elicited an interesting comment from a pastor friend who said, "I don't know too many people who are so serious about religion they can't even go to church." Even as I exemplified the pain and anger of a feminist looking warily at a religion that has so often used a male savior to keep women in their place, I was drawn to the strong old women in the congregation. Their well-worn Bible said to me, "There is more here than you know," and made me take more seriously the religion that caused my grandmother Totten's Bible to be so well used that its spine broke. I also began slowly to make sense of our gathering together on Sunday morning, recognizing, however dimly, that church is to be participated in and not consumed. The point is not what one gets out of it, but the worship of God. The service takes place both because of and despite the needs, strengths, and frailties of the people present. How else could it be? Now, on the occasions when I am able to actually worship in church, I am deeply grateful. But the question of inheritance still haunts me, and I sometimes have the radical notion that I'm a Christian the way a Jew is a Jew, by maternal lineage. Flannery O'Connor remarks in her letters that, quote, Most of us come to the church by a means the church does not allow. And I may have put on my grandmother Totten's religion until it became my own. But the currents of this female inheritance spring from deep waters. Mary is also my ancestor, as is Eve. As Emily Dickinson once said, "You know there is no account of her death in the Bible, and why am I not Eve? Or why not my two grandmothers, reflecting two of American Protestantism that exist in me as a continual tension between curse and blessing, pietism and piety, law and grace, the God of wrath and the God of love, the two grandmothers within her symbolizing a tension within Protestantism. When I was very small, my fundamentalist grandmother Norris, meaning well, told me about the personal experience I'd have with Jesus one day. She talked about Jesus coming and the world ending. It sounded a lot like a fairy tale when the prince comes, only scarier. Fundamentalism is about control more than grace. And in effect, my grandmother implanted the seed of fundamentalism within me, a shadow in Jungian terms, that has been difficult to overcome. Among other things, it made of Christological language a stumbling block and told me that as a feminist, as a thinking and questioning person, I had no business being in church. More insidiously, it embedded in me an unconscious belief in a monster God. For most of my life, you could not have convinced me that, to quote a Quaker friend, trust comes before belief. And faith is a response to love more than an acceptance of dogma. Trust is something abused children lack, and children raised with a monster God inside them have a hard time regaining it. Any reactions to those passages? I guess I have the same ambivalence about a lot of Christianity. I love it and I hate it in its different expressions.
Yeah, I was brought up in a Catholic church, and it was pounded in the Roman Catholic orphanage in third grade. I was in a convent, and I was all over. And boy, if you didn't go to sleep like this, you'd die. You'd go to hell. Mm. So when I got to the age of reason, well, I'm almost there. I didn't go to church again, hardly until I met my husband 10 years ago from Ronald Lutheran. Pretty good. But he was my inspiration for that.
I think I also really like her emphasis on trust. That what's fundamental in, I think another theme that we talked about in the last discussion on Patricia Hampel was that that belief and sort of intellectual cognitive understanding are all important, but in a way they come later, and that there's something more basic, more fundamental involved in trust, confidence, faith, feelings of connectedness that have to lay the groundwork for all that theology and dogma or doctrine, or it just seems like heavy, oppressive, abstract ideas. At least that speaks to my understanding.
It's a really interesting tension, because I share that too, and I just feel again and again and again the heaviness and inappropriateness oftentimes are of the dogma, of the doctrinal language of the church. Mm-hmm. When you put it up against the poetry and the beauty and all of the qualities that the church seems to sacrifice so easily in the name of the dogma that it holds on to so rigidly, I just it's a wonder that I keep going back. It's a tribute to the spirit, the spiritual power of the church that I keep going back, because I don't understand it either. That's a beautiful articulation of that. You know, how can you survive in the midst of that, the heaviness of the doctrine?
But I don't hear the heaviness in this passage in the dogma. I hear the heaviness in the grandmothers. And as a result, the grandmothers, the echoes of the grandmothers' language is what makes that dogmatic language so heavy. And I'm trying to think of the name of the theologian. A friend of mine just sent me a letter just before we left, quoting a theologian that talked about the importance of facing original sin in your own house. The place we need to face original sin is our own home. And that's what I hear her wrestling with.
How do these doctrines or dogmas actually make sense of my own life? You know, not as abstractions, but my own house.
Yeah, and not even that as much as I think they were circumstantial of the heaviness that those women embodied in her life. And so every time she heard dogma, it was a re-experience of that.
Yeah.
I've had an interesting experience this year. I teach Old Testament confirmation to seventh graders and have for a long time. But this year, at the end of every lesson, the children, the students, are asked to go home, and there's a lesson they do, and then at the end, there's always a parent question that they must discuss with their parent. It has to come back signed and et cetera, so we know they do it. And the parents oftentimes write their answers out on the back of the assignment, and then sometime during the class period, we ask them to share that in discussion. For example, if the lesson is on creation, how do you feel the world was created? And you talk that over with your parents and then come back. The children are absolutely eager to share what their parents have said. And in so doing, their parents have given them a gift. But then the gift extends itself because they're sharing all this variety of views that are not alike, that are dissimilar. But then we come to the conclusion, even in that dissimilarity, we're all believing that God created the world. And so some of the barriers of dogma and structure are dispelled, and children are able to understand that they can believe a lot within certain theological understanding. And it's been really profound for me to see this again and again. Questions on homosexuality, questions on divorce, questions on pacifism. And we all come at it at different angles under the umbrella of our belief in God.
So in your experience, there's room for a lot of, there's not an orthodoxy that is oppressive, but at least the way you're doing this, there is room for some differences of interpretation about what...
It's like a quilt. A lot of patches put together, it becomes a beautiful piece.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question. Has the church... I mean, is this a historical point that is no longer true about the church? Or is the kind of oppressive... I mean, I've heard other people, not just in this room, but at various points, express similar feelings of... the church often seems, over intellectualized or abstract or insisting on a kind of orthodoxy that makes them feel left out. So let me just leave you with that question. If does this illuminate your own experience of the church or not? Is she talking about something else? Let me read one last quote about her family. Religion is in my blood and in my ghosts. It is a hard religion, adding fuel to an all-American mix of incest, rape, madness, and suicide that nearly destroyed an entire generation in my family. My father's status as oldest remaining son, his musical talent, a sense of humor, and a solid marriage helped save him. But my aunts suffered terribly, and one was lost. I never met her. She died the year I was born. She died of lots of things, sex and fundamentalist religion, and schizophrenia and postpartum despair. She was a good girl who became pregnant out of wedlock and could make no room for the bad girl in herself. She jumped out of a window at a state mental hospital a few days after she had her baby. Looking at an old family photograph when I was 12, I saw a face I didn't recognize. Asking who this was, I first heard her story. Suicides have a way of haunting the next generation. And adolescence is when most of us begin to know who we will be. I believe I became a writer in order to tell her story and possibly redeem it. This goes much deeper than anything I understand. But in part, I also joined a church because of her. I needed to find that woman, her aunt, sacrificed to a savage God. I needed to make sure she was forgiven and at peace. The first time I stayed at a monastery hermitage, I surfaced one day for morning prayer with the community. My stomach was growling, anticipating breakfast, and I was restless. A monk read what I've since learned is a prayer they say every morning, that all their deceased confreres, oblates, relatives, benefactors, and friends may rest in the peace of the risen Christ. That morning, I knew it was done. I didn't have to worry about my aunt anymore. They tell me this is Catholic theology, not Protestant. I couldn't care less. Her name was Mary, and she had good pitch. The church was music to her, and she sang all her life in church choirs. Powerful passage, I think, about how this aunt who committed suicide in Norris's mind, partly because of the, what would we say, the moralistic aspects of fundamentalism. She has a baby out of wedlock and internalizes guilt and shame about that and kills herself. And Norris thinks that her religion partly contributed to that. And yet the aunt also sang all her life in church choirs and loved music. And her name was Mary. And so it's like this aunt Mary has within herself both the love and the rebellion and the pain of Christianity that Norris herself has experienced. Any quick thoughts about ancestors, female? I mean, this is a subject that you could spend a lifetime on, that the way that your mother, your grandmother, your aunt or your father plant seeds in your understanding of what religion is, that in a way you're working through for the rest of your life. I mean, maybe that's just one particular notion of what Lutheranism or Catholicism or something is, but because mom had it, that's your idea of it for an awful lot of your life.
What I seem to have inherited is a diversity, like you were talking about. Mm. That I had a Scandinavian grandmother on one hand telling me all the Scandinavian gods and mm-hmm. all of those guys up in the sky that were making the thunder and what they were doing. You know, it was very, mm-hmm. it seemed at age 5 or 6, it was very real to her mm-hmm. and almost real to me. I think I knew somewhat the difference between fantasy and reality. But those stories, I think, provided that there are other views of why things are and why we have trouble, and even though the other grandmother was Welsh and had a whole other tradition to pass on to me, they were both very active in their churches too. You know, they did the right things in the community. But I think those other lineages gave me some there are alternative ways of looking at things, mm-hmm. and I think that was a strength that they. That they had in themselves too, that, well, if one way of looking at things doesn't work, let's try it explaining it with another way.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a real gift to give a child the sense of the variety of of options within Christianity, the, you know, the variety of traditions, the pluralism within Christianity, and the way that we all have to kind of make some choices about what Christianity means to us. We can make some choices. It's not just necessarily take it or leave it. It's
because I struggle with that. You say these poor writers are also rebelling against their memory, and I've certainly done some of that myself and now come back to it. And I'm raising children in what I hope is a different Christian atmosphere than what I was raised in, but I don't know, you know, I mean, they're going to rebel against this stuff. I'm sort of struggling with, am I making it more accessible and something that they may not bolt from like I did? That's the carrying that on, like, what am I doing? They're going to remember.
Yeah.
Right. And I may unintentionally be pushing them the other way, you know. I struggle with that.
Or what am I doing that they may need to be healed from?
Yeah.
You
know, really.
That here, there's so much here about the healing of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And that the memory is much bigger than Kathleen Norris's even personal history. She knew this aunt through a picture. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the power that that memory had in her whole consciousness.
Mm-hmm. The healing of memory is another way in which writing an autobiography is, as I think, a sort of spiritual act. Autobiography, again, is not just about the past. It's a present act. It's a need. You know, why does somebody go back to the past? It's out of some urgent present need. And and healing is a great word for it.
And isn't the book dedicated to Mary?
I'm trying to remember. I don't even remember. In memory of Kathleen Dakota and Mary Beatrice. I hadn't even noticed that. Yeah. Let me go on finally in the last 10 minutes or so to a final series of shorter readings on monks, because even though Norris herself stays a Protestant, she's very drawn to these Benedictine monasteries in the Dakotas. And I think her descriptions of what about those monasteries appeals to her is not applicable only to monasteries, but in some ways to Holden, and in some ways to what the way I would like to live my life if I could be a better Christian, if I could get my act together a little better. I wish I could do some of this in my own life too. Benedict called on monks to live a perpetual Lent, yet he made rest and reading part of their schedule. And modern monasteries usually have a daily period of communal recreation. Here we approach the balance that is at the heart of monastic life. What do monks have to do with recreation, with fun? Benedictines regard all time as holy and seek to use it well. The point is not to avoid having fun, but to keep in balance one's need for food, work, prayer, rest, and play. Moderation is essential, for in the words of Ama Synclitica, a 4th century desert nun, lack of proportion always corrupts. The fact that such balance is considered ascetic says a great deal about our consumer culture. After my first stay in a monastery, where I saw Saturn and its rings through a telescope, and watched monks tend their apple as many of their winter vegetables, I happened to go directly to a shopping mall. It was easy to see which was the more unhealthy, otherworldly environment, which place was out of balance, and which was, in fact, the most fun. Still, even in the relatively liberal monasteries I visit, the perpetual Lent is much in evidence. Talk to almost any novice 6 months into the life. They're bored shitless, I'm quoting, and feel terribly constrained, confined. For good or ill, they become almost unbearably aware of the little things as they move more fully into the community. Experiencing a daily familiarity with other people that is usually found only in family life. Their struggle to learn to tolerate other people's foibles often reflects what one sister termed Benedict's insight that living in community is the only asceticism you need. This is not a shallow remark. For the Benedictine, celibacy itself is part of one's commitment to the community. Eschewing love affairs that would disrupt and diminish the communal bonds a monastery seeks to maintain. Gradually, the novice discovers that a forced observation of little things can also lead to simple pleasures. A young monk once told me he'd been delighted to find that the worn black wool of the habit he'd been given was excellent for sliding down banisters. He demonstrated it and for a moment became an angel, without feet, all irrepressible joy. It's when novices move towards survival, embracing the deprivations of monastic life as a personal inner necessity, that they begin to feel truly free. They also begin to understand the depths of joy and how little it has to do with what the world calls happiness. Like the farmer or rancher who willingly takes on economic hardship, remaining in Dakota out of love for the land, these monks can grow to a profound understanding of fast and feast. Good Holden idea there, too. One makes sense only in terms of the other, and both may be seen in terms of play. Like country folk everywhere, monks develop an ability to party simply but well. No one celebrates like we do, says one monk. It was the play as much as the piety of the monks that inspired me and helped me to survive. We had eaten together, laughed, sung psalms, inhabited silence, and played out in liturgy the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem. All of it could be summoned up on my darkest days as a reminder of the rich play life could be. Play so powerful that it can absorb adults, becoming their way of life, may have a meaning that children's play lacks. While there is an analogy between a child calling a chair a horse and a priest changing bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, there's also a difference. In play, we create and manipulate the rules. In liturgy, we act out something that has been handed down to us, and in making it our own, we are also responding to the mysterium tremendum. Taking the playful aspects of liturgy into account, we need also to recognize the utterly serious attitudes and intentions of those involved, and the serious effect it has on them. For the monk, the play of liturgy is a means of conversion, a way of life. In its deeper satisfactions, it confers an abiding sense of peace. What sets monks apart from the rest of us is not an overbearing piety, but a contemplative sense of fun. They know, as Trappist monk Matthew Kelty reminds us, that you do not have to be holy to love God, you have only to be human. Nor do you have to be holy to see God in all things. You have only to play as a child with an unselfish heart. The play of monks comes out of what I earlier termed an inner necessity, the humble acknowledgement that for them, the liturgy must be a daily affair, a chore. They need to act it out, making the circle, singing and saying and hearing the words again and again, as a child asks to hear a beloved story many times over. And the last paragraph I'll read. Let us go now to monks at play, finishing dinner and enjoying a sunset. The World Series is over, and tonight, for the first time this week, there's no talk of baseball at table. A monk and guest are parrying with tales of Eloise and Abelard. The monk's face brightens almost innocently as he says, "It was the Benedictines who castrated him, you know." Another monk who has been enjoying the discussion rises and says, "I hate to leave you, but I have pots and pans tonight." Yet another sign, he says, sighing, that the parousia has not yet come. As he strides away, His scapular flutters behind him like a wink. The monks will have recreation in the cloister. I'll walk the monastery grounds. Coyotes will begin calling in the coulees to the north. Soon the monks too will begin to sing the gentle lullaby of vespers and compline, at one with the rhythm of evening, the failing light and the rise of the moon. Together, monks and coyotes will sing the world to sleep. A beautiful passage, I think, that gets at, for me, something about why I come to hold, and also to be part of a larger, to be part of a rhythm that I didn't make. You know, the Vespers is every night at 8, and it's the community has a life of its own. It's something that I think in different ways we hunger for. And the balance, ideally at least, of holding of work, play, thought, prayer, music, that I at least can't ever seem to quite create in my supposedly normal life. But I love that ideal of balance, of a life that's not perfect by excelling in one thing, but by including everything in it, integrated and in its place. And the ideal of a kind of a rhythm in which play has a place. Any thoughts on monks holding or whatever?
All of that, and that the rhythm is tied to the earth.
Mm, yes.
And to the natural, and to the movement. I was talking with somebody who's been here two winters now the other day about what the winter community is like. Mm. And she said, well, and you know the snow. the most gentle way of saying the snow is also a lot of work.
Yeah.
But it was that one of the reasons that the rhythm is so different in the winter is not just that the people and the community and all that, but the weather is different too. Mm. And that it changes the rhythm of life. Mm-hmm. So that the rhythm includes responding to that, participating in that.
The rhythm is tied to the cycles of the earth.
Yeah. It's very real on a farm.
Yeah.
Very, very real on a farm where the glory of spring and spring work is our fall and fall work. Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up on a farm?
No, but I spent extended amounts of time with relatives. I grew up in South Dakota. Mm-hmm.
I think it was in our world, it's so geared toward work and production and being impressed with how much we get done.
Increasing the pace.
And yeah, and it just adds to the pace and increases chaos. And and I just think we get really out of balance when we are so devoted to work and don't see play as a priority too.
Yeah.
Play and rest.
Mm-hmm. Fun to be in Golden and like yesterday, hiked up to Golden Lake, and to think that we were seeing something. I mean, they can see it from the air, but they can't see it from the angle we can see it at. And then the only way you can see it is to put one foot in front of the other and pant and sweat and get up there. The only thing that I miss, you know, like the Dakotas and even the San Fernando Valley where I live, the animals at night, you can hear them, and that's what I miss. The mountain animals are quiet. You don't have any howling or any.
And in the San Fernando Valley,
you have the nightingale, and you have the mockingbird, and you have the coyote, because I live right up against the Chatsworth Reservoir, which is full of deer and coyotes. And even though I'm a suburb of L.A., there's carjackings a mile away from me, I'm still right up against this. And I think that's what people don't realize about the open. Animals are evidently more willing to let you know they're there with their sounds. Because here at night, you don't hear any animal sounds at all.
Maybe it's partly that the trees soak up some of this, muffle some of the sound a little bit.
There are no coyotes, and the wolves were all killed off. Mm-hmm. And only things that would howl, I guess. Mm. But there's no night birds either.
Yeah, there's a great horned owl all last night.
There was. Yeah, sure. I wish I'd known. I'd love to have heard it.
Yeah, I heard it all night.
The marmots make weird noises sometimes.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
Is that what that is?
There's this high, it's almost like somebody's screaming or a whistle, yeah.
That's,
there's a pika out there too. Mm. You don't usually see the pikas, but they're in the center of the rocks.
I understand there are some eagles flying around here, but I haven't seen one.
And there aren't any mountain lions or cougars.
Yeah.
There are.
There'll be some somewhere.
Yeah, there are.
Interesting.
And you probably don't want to be close enough to hear the bear.
Well, the bear, I guess, is more frightened of you. The only time a bear would attack, I guess, is if you were in between, you know, him and his cub. Or her cub.
Yeah. Certainly for Native Americans, the spiritual geography of, the spiritual geography of a place is related very much to what animals and birds, live in that place.